Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 2nd of November, 2022, and this is Reconstruction, the Construction Index podcast, with me, magazine editor David Taylor, and online news editor Phil Bishop. Morning, Phil.
Morning, David. How are things down there in sunny Devon?
Well, not sunny at the moment. Cold and, well, relatively cold and definitely wet. But that's what you get in the West Country, so I shouldn't complain. So, well, actually, Phil, I was thinking that given the speed at which the political landscape is changing in this country at the moment, it would probably be a good idea to just set the scene so that we have some context for our discussion today. So Rishi Sunak is still the Prime Minister and Jeremy Hunt is still Chancellor of the Exchequer. I checked this just before we started recording and I'll check again just before we finish, make sure they're still there. But did you know that the Construction Minister is somebody called Jackie Doyle Price? Does that name ring any bells with you?
It means nothing to me, but I had heard that. But I think she was Liz Truss's appointment and hasn't been moved yet, I believe, rather than... I mean, she's been there for more than a fortnight, hasn't she?
Well, that was it, yeah. I think that the thing is that she sort of got lost in all the upheaval. And she was appointed as a minister in the Department of Business, BEIS. What does that stand for? I can never remember.
Enterprise Industrial Strategy.
That's the one. But she didn't. I don't think she had an actual role. She didn't have a job. But yeah, I think only very recently she's actually been named as the Construction Minister. And she's also, I believe, the new co-chair of the Construction Industry Council. I mean, this is all stuff that I was just browsing on the internet, and it just sort of popped up.
Yes, I'm not sure whether that's... Things keep changing in the junior ranks of ministers. Yeah. I read this morning that Rebecca Powell, who's one of my favourite ministers, actually, in the environment, yeah, who is from farming stock and knows what she's doing and is an unusual example of someone in a ministerial job who actually knows something about the subject that they're supposed to know about. she was one of those dozens or hundreds, no, dozens of ministers who resigned in the dog days of Boris Johnson's tail end. And she's just come back, I believe, at the Department for DEFRA or whichever one it is.
Oh, right, yeah.
So, yeah. So that's quite good. It's a bit like the other one who's come back in education is Nick Gibb, the schools minister, son of a civil engineer. But he's been an education minister on and off just about forever. And he keeps coming back. So, what did you say her name was?
Jackie Doyle Price, her name is. I'd never heard of her before. I think she's an Essex MP. Thurrock, I think, is her constituency. I have to say, I didn't recognise the name at all. And I don't know, I felt almost as if she'd sort of snuck in under the radar. Look, she's suddenly construction minister. But she's going to have her work cut out, I think, because her remit includes infrastructure, and there's rather a lot of that going on at the moment.
The one I'm more interested in is the new Secretary of State for Transport, Mark Harper, who's not someone I know much about. He was quite... he was the former chief whip. He was... against the COVID lockdowns or against the more restrictive elements of the COVID lockdown. He chaired the COVID recovery group of Tory MPs who were kind of saying, you know, let's put the economy first before other considerations like people's health, sounded like. Anyway, he's in the cabinet as Secretary of State for Transport and one of the new cabinet people. I did a quick Google to see what we know about him. And he's state school educated, accountant, and Oxford PPE person, along with so many of the other cabinet, it seems. But the fact that he's a chartered accountant, I think, is quite interesting in the current situation, because as Secretary of State for Transport, it's going to be very much up to him and Chancellor of the Exchequer, Jeremy Hunt. Mm-hmm. This is what happens to all these big infrastructure projects, which they are going to have to cut budgets. We know they're going to have to cut budgets. And I didn't hear it, but it was on the radio this morning, Mark Harper being interviewed, basically saying, well, HS2, we're going to keep doing what we're doing, but we're going to have to find more ways to cut costs. Not cut costs, but cut costs. And this is interesting in all sorts of ways. This morning's news on the Construction Index website was that the Lower Thames Crossing planning application, the development consent order application, has finally been submitted to the planning inspectorate 2 years after they submitted a pre-submission, a notice of pre-application they lodged, say, we're just about to lodge our application for this project. Everything okay? And the planning inspector said, no, your paperwork's rubbish. Go away and do some more work on it.
Yeah.
And it's taken them 2 years to come back again, which was very handy because they couldn't afford it then and they can't afford it now. It's now been talked as a £10 billion project. They can't afford it. But it's one of the top five projects in the road investment strategy, RIS 2, which is the period we're now in.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
What is that? 21 to 26? I'm not quite sure what the... No, 20 to 25 RIS 2.
Okay.
But why are Lower Thames Crossing in that period? It's not going to start before March 2025. But there's all sorts of the road projects which are going massively over budget because of
inflation. Well, yeah.
And other things. We also ran a piece last week about the A66. The Department for Transport had a look at this. The Bernadette Kelly, the senior civil servant there, who's the chief accounting officer, I think is the jargon, produced a report on it, basically saying that it is not good value for money.
Mm.
I'm just going to check I've got her name right there. Yeah, Bernadette Kelly, principal accounting officer, Department for Transport. The cost-benefit ratio, or the benefit cost ratio, is 0.9, i.e. less than one, and therefore not good value for money.
Yep.
And that is even before counting in inflation. They haven't included inflation in that equation. So it's only going to get worse.
But they've decided to go ahead with it.
Well, they're going ahead with the work towards it. I mean, they've appointed it. They've already chosen the contractors for it.
Yeah.
But what they're trying to do it's three contractors that they've got to do. Rather like A14, is that what it was?
Yeah.
The one across Essex to the A1 to the M11 kind of thing.
Yes, that's
where they bunged all the contractors in a group together, and this is what they've done with the A13. I'm trying to remember who it is. I've got Balfour Beatty, Keir and Keltbray in my head, and I can't.
Yeah, and Costain as well.
And Costain, that's it. Yeah. So four contractors work together in collaboration, and this is all kind of like we've got to get the cost down. Got to get the cost down because it already doesn't. It's already, you know, it's not good value for money even without the inflation element brought in. So they're value engineering like mad, desperately trying to make the A66 duelling, which I should say is north of the Pennines, A1M at Scotch Corner to the M6 at Penrith. Some of that's already dual carriageway, but a lot of it isn't. And it's quite a major east-west artery across the north of England. But, of course, it goes through Lake District National Park and some beautiful parts of God's own country, and very, very environmentally sensitive.
And it's an expensive job anyway, isn't it? I mean, the latest estimate is nearly £1.5 billion. Which, I don't know, doesn't sound like value for money to me. I would have expected a brand new road for that sort of price, but this is just an improvement job. But they want to do it, don't they? Because it's an important component of the government's levelling up strategy. You know, this whole idea that we've got to improve communications, sort of north of Watford Junction, and that this is a crucial east-west corridor. So they decided they've got to go ahead with it. The thing, I find it hard to sort of reconcile the fact that it's vitally important and yet poor value for money, because I think there are some things which you've got to do at any price. I mean, they haven't said they're going to build this at any price, but they're clearly considering doing it at the price they've got at the moment. If that's the price, it's like sort of market economics, isn't it? If that's the price, that's what it costs, you've got to do it. Whether or not you feel you've had value for money is almost irrelevant, I think.
Do you have to do it?
Well, they've decided. Well, yes, I think the government has decided that it has to do it because it's such an important part of the levelling up strategy. Not to do it would be an admission of failure. Maybe they would be prepared to do that. But I think that they're in too deep. So much depends upon it. You don't agree?
Well, I don't know. I kind of think back to the days of the Channel Tunnel planning days when you and I were both Cub reporters, when I have a figure in my head of 10 billion is what the Channel Tunnel eventually cost, which seems like an absolute bargain now. But it transpired that whatever the number they said it was going to cost was, they thought of a number which they thought they could sell to Parliament, to the public, and to get through, and said, we'll use this number and we'll work around it. We know it won't cost this, but this is what we'll say it's going to cost. And then we'll get going, and then we can, to a less extent than it is with HS2 as well. And it seems to be, certainly to a cynical mind, the way of big public sector projects. Things always cost more than they estimate at the outset. Not because the estimate at the outset is, or that anyone has miscalculated. It's a political estimate. We don't want to come up with a number so high that everyone goes, well, that's a stupid idea, we can't possibly do that. So whatever number they come up with for the A66 is going to be a number that just manages to get that benefit-cost ratio above 1.001. Yeah. They'll find a way to move the needle just above that. Say, there we go, good value for money, let's do it. And it won't necessarily come out as good value for money, even though the forecasts say it's going to be good value for money.
No, that's true. And of course, I know there are people whose entire careers are built on estimating costs in major infrastructure jobs. But something as huge and complex as a road project, it must be almost impossible to accurately estimate, because apart from anything else, you don't have a crystal ball. And projects like these take time. And as we know, you've just mentioned it to do with this job, the estimate doesn't actually take into account inflation. And as we've seen this year, inflation ain't what it was when this was first planned. It's a lot more. So you have to get a figure that will get it over the line.
That's it.
And then try and justify any increases after that. So this... go on.
Having sounded slightly cynical about it all, equally, with any of these big projects, and I go back to the Channel Tunnel or the M25 or anything that was transformative, you kind of think, in hindsight, when it's there and we're living with it, we think, well, what were we worried about? And can you imagine living in the southeast of England without having the M25 motorway as a London orbital motorway? I mean, I know it's useless more often than it's brilliant, and it does tend to get clogged up and so on and so forth, and we moan about having to drive on the damn thing. But if it didn't exist...
Where would all that traffic be?
Whatever it costs, we want it. Once these, you know, roads, for all the pollution and emissions and noise and bad stuff that they create, once they're there, you kind of think, well, what were we arguing about?
Yeah, that's very true. And I suppose that will be the same with HS2, you know, which isn't my favourite project, but. Once that's there, people will say, well, you know, however do we manage before getting from London to Birmingham? I can't quite convince myself of that right now. But even that, you ran a story, I think last week, wasn't it, about HS2. The government has admitted that it isn't being as productive as it ought to be.
Yeah. Yes, this is the first big statement from Mark Harper, the new Transport Secretary. Mm. In the legislation, there is a requirement, the enabling legislation to build HS2, there is a requirement placed upon the relevant government minister to make a half-yearly report to Parliament saying how it's going, just to, you know, make sure that it's not getting too expensive. Mm-hmm. And all that kind of stuff. Now, there used to be, in the old days of 6 months ago, a minister for HS2. No one's got that job at the moment, specifically the minister for HS2. So the Secretary of State had the job of presenting the report.
Mm.
I think it's reading out someone else's work, to be fair. I mean, he'd only been in job a few days at this stage. But it's full of these wonderful euphemisms. Like, it doesn't say we've overrun or we've spent too much. It talks about net additional cost pressures. And, you know, cost pressure is the euphemism.
Yeah.
And how much of the contingency budget? I mean, they say it's going to cost X, but we're going to have a contingency budget of Y that we can draw down from. And they're drawing down on the contingency budget fairly rapidly.
Yes.
We've got a £5.6 billion contingency budget, which is, you know, money that they can spend but really would rather not. And they've already drawn down £1.5 billion of that, £200 million in this last 6 months. So we've got about £4 billion of contingency left, and we're still a long way to go. And that's, we know, as per Crossrail taught us and many other things, that actually digging tunnels and earthworks and so on is the easy bit. Wait till you get the train set being put in place
and
the Crossrail. That's when your costs start going up.
Yeah.
So, hey.
But it's the whole idea of the contingency, I don't know if that's standard practice in major infrastructure projects, because I haven't really encountered it in the past. But it seems to me like a rather clever way of actually allowing costs to escalate without having to admit it, because, you know, the contingency is already there. I mean, they could say this is going to cost us £140 billion and make a contingency of another £140 billion and, you know, double their costs and still say they're within budget. It seems an interesting concept to have this sort of buffer sum there, you know, that you can dip into if you need to. And as you say, there's quite a helpful table that you've posted online with the story, which shows how they've been dipping into it ever since October 2020, when there was £5.3 billion left. October 2022 is down to £4 billion. So they've been, you know, dipping their hand in the till, you know, quite consistently over this period.
Yes. What they're going to have to do, basically, is I think, for HS2 and for government spending overall, to sort out the economy. We know they're going to be public spending cuts and tax rises. They're avoiding using the word austerity. They don't want to go back to those days particularly. They still want to try and talk about growth a la Trussonomics, even though, obviously, she's been discredited, or her politics, I should say.
Yes,
But I think politically the only way the government can square the circle on this, as I said last time we spoke, is to still commit to all of these projects, but simply to slow it down.
Mm.
You know, push. I mentioned this RIS2 road building program. Things will get pushed into RIS3.
Yes. Yeah. Obviously, that, I suppose that's a good way of managing it, because, you know, it's money that, you know, you're going to have to spend sooner or later if it's in the next tranche. So just shove it in there.
Also, you make it Keir Starmer's problem.
Yeah, that's true. Almost certainly.
Should we move on to another driving topic?
Yes, I think that's a good idea. Good analogy as well.
Go on, this one tickled your interest. You tell us about it.
I like this because it's just clever. Well, it seems clever anyway. It's this idea of drive-through concrete. We did a story a couple of weeks ago on the international sort of news page of the website about there's an international cement and concrete organization. Hasn't been going all that long, and they produced this report. I think we mentioned it in the last podcast, actually, saying that in developing countries, bagged cement is used a lot more than sort of ready-mixed concrete and stuff like that. It tends to be mixed on site, and it's very inefficient. And the concrete and cement industry wants to tackle its enormous carbon footprint. And so it's going to encourage the use of bulk concrete and bulk cement deliveries in the developing world. Well, this was a story which comes from Denmark. It's an organization called FIBO Intercon, or FIBO Intercon. I don't know how to pronounce it. And they're launching a system, which I think is already operating in Denmark. They're launching a concept in the UK, which is basically a sort of a do-it-yourself batching plant, which will be located at, say, your local building builder's merchant, probably a heavy side merchant.
Well, it's self-service,
yes, that's
rather
right.
than do-it-yourself,
yes.
isn't it? It's like a vending machine for concrete.
Yeah, it's like sort of going getting yourself an espresso or a cappuccino or an Americano or a latte or whatever you want from a machine in a motorway service station. You know, you go on the touch screen, you select the recipe, you swipe your bank card, and lo and behold, the machine, the batting plant, mixes up whatever type of mix you want. And there's a whole range of additives which can be included in the recipe, and then delivers it off a conveyor belt into your truck. So the great thing about this is, of course, that this is for small batches. I mean, really small batches. I think I haven't got the story in front of me, but I think the smallest you can get is half a cubic meter, which is tiny. But then what you get is a good, reliable and efficiently mixed concrete delivery straight into your vehicle, and then you can take it back to your site and, you know, put down the slab for your shed or whatever it happens to be. So it's small enough to appeal to DIYers. But as when I was talking to you about this... Go on, what are you going to...
Yes, you say DIYers. I do occasional bit of DIY, but I don't have a pickup truck.
No.
Now, I'm not going to put this in the back of my family saloon. you know, you do need a flatbed pickup truck that you're prepared to jet wash down.
Yeah,
after
that is true.
You've emptied the concrete out of
that. That is the Achilles heel, I think, because the system is absolutely brilliant right up until the very last stage in the process, which is the delivery to the customer.
And if I'm going to want concrete, it's probably going to be not very near where I can park my car in front of my house. So you're going to have to
barrow it,
lots of wheelbarrows loads. You know, shovel it into the wheelbarrow, wheel the barrow around the house or whatever, and then shovel it out, pour it out the wheelbarrow. So I don't think it's a DIY. There will be small builders for whom this is absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
They don't have to bother with cement mixers on site. I don't see it as a DIY thing.
No.
Even though the scale sort of works, I don't think the logistics work.
Maybe sort of small domestic projects, you know, like the footings for your shed. I was thinking about how I might approach this issue if I wanted to avail myself of the service, and the only way I thought would be to get a couple of dozen buckets, stand underneath the conveyor with my buckets and a helper, filling them up and putting them in the back of my van and then driving them away and then carrying them bucket by bucket to where I needed the concrete, which isn't ideal, I have to admit. That's where the whole idea becomes too difficult for your average DIYer. I think that there's a video, actually, which I think you posted online, which shows it in operation.
Yeah, it's there with the story.
And in the video, you can see that the conveyor is depositing the concrete into the flatbed of a rather smart pickup, actually. But presumably, there's an awful lot of cleaning up to do afterwards. I like the idea. I mean, batching plants, they're already automated. You know, there's somebody in a control office or something like that, dialing in the recipe and getting it sorted out. And there's a queue of mixer trucks waiting to take it all away. So this is, I suppose, technically not really a challenge. It's simply just scaling down existing technology. It's the application and the fact that it's so convenient and so efficient, because, you know, if you think about your average local builder, he will get in contact with his local builder's merchant, and he'll have a pallet of cement bags delivered to his customer's house and a couple of dumpy bags of aggregate, and he'll be using water from the customer's tap, and he'll have a drum mixer, and he'll do it all himself, and he will have cement left over almost certainly, or he'll have cement which is wasted. They'll have aggregate that's wasted, whereas there's absolutely no wastage with this. You want half a cubic meter of a particular mix, that's what you get. You don't get any more. As long as you use it all, I guess that's your wastage dealt with. So I like the idea.
No, I do. We're tipped off about it not by Phoebo or Fibo at all, although, to be fair, the man who wrote to us was so enthusiastic, I can't help thinking he might have a slight commercial vested interest. Yeah. I don't know. A chap called Stuart Cranfield, who's managing director of Bell Meadow, which is a house builder in Cheshire, high-end house builder in Cheshire. He says these things, they're already in France, and we can see them going all over the UK. It would save builders like us a lot of hassle and money. So he's very excited by it. He thinks it's a game changer.
I don't know of any outlet. And, sorry.
I was going to say, what I think is interesting is the route to market. The fact that it's aimed at, it's a mini batching plant with your self-service automation, press button, swipe your card, that builders merchant, so a builders merchant yard would put in. So it's another revenue stream for builders merchants potentially. And if they've got space for it, think, well, why wouldn't they? They might not like the idea of the clearing up. The machine itself is self-cleaning the inside gubbins of it, but you know there are going to be dopey drivers who drive off and spill bits of concrete out the back of the truck. So a bit like those the people who get their coffee from the motorway service station coffee machines just before you or I go.
Take their cup away too early.
Everywhere.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm not aware of any outlets actually offering this service at the moment. Are you? I don't. I did a bit of a Google, and there's an outfit called Kelly Tanks, which actually I think advertise with us occasionally, and who had something on their website about it. But I don't know whether or not you can actually go to any builders merchants at the moment and use this service.
Well, I think this is right at the front end. We're on this story early, and we're telling builders merchants that here's a new revenue stream opportunity for you. So, hopefully we'll be hearing all about it from the builders merchants before too long.
Yeah. So on to another topic then, Phil. And this one is a blast from the past, I think. I mean, it's a name. Name I wasn't expecting to hear very much from after the events of 2019, and that name is Interserve. But they're being sued. Interserve not only just still exists, but they're being taken to court. They have been. Yeah, tell us about it.
They have been fined. They have been. Well, I don't think they've been taken to court exactly, but it's the UK Information Commissioner's Office has issued with them a fine for £4.4 million for failing to prevent a cyber attack, basically. Here's the story. In May 2020, an Interserve employee forwarded a dodgy phishing email to a colleague, not knowing what it was. The colleague opened it, downloaded it, the contents, and a whole load of horrible malware got onto the employee's workstation. And from there into the entire Interserve IT system, it compromised 283 systems and 16 accounts, uninstalled the company's antivirus system, and encrypted and rendered unavailable the personal data of up to 113,000 current and former employees. Mm. In other words, it was an awful mess. It was a nightmare.
I mean, it's not as if Interserve didn't have enough on its plate at the time, but this was,
No, well, this was after, I mean, Interserve was in administration this time. Now, the various things interesting about this. First of all, I can't add much clarity, but people might go, Interserve, how's that being fined? I thought it didn't exist anymore. Well, technically, the company that has been fined £4.4 million is Interserve Group Limited, which does still exist. But Interserve Group Limited was only formed in February 2019, which is about the same time that Interserve PLC went into administration. Interserve PLC is now in liquidation. It's in the hands of Ernst & Young. It still sort of legally exists, but it's in liquidation, soon won't. I don't understand how Interserve Group Limited still exists, unless it may well have purely been set up to take the rap. They knew this. Well, actually, in February 19, they wouldn't know this is coming down the line. So I don't know. Maybe it's just a residual thing for liabilities. I'm not an accountant. I'm not an administrative receiver type person. I don't know why Interserve Group Limited exists.
No, I don't.
But it does. And it's £4.4 million the poorer.
I mean, has it got £4.4 million? I mean, if it has, why has it got it?
Well, it seems to be...
It's got creditors, for God's sake.
Yeah, yeah. Then people are going to lose out. The creditors, if they actually are creditors of Interserve Group Limited rather than Interserve PLC. But it's almost not important that Interserve has to pay £4.4 million. What this is a there but for the grace of God go I story, because we all get these dodgy emails, and most of us have got, you know, our antivirus systems and a little bit of savvy that we these days know what looks and smells phishing, so don't open it. But still, you know, we can all come a cropper, as Interserve did, because they didn't have their systems in place. Now, it occurred to me that the villain of the piece here is the person who sent the malware to Interserve. And fining Interserve £4.4 million for being mugged, you know, because it was wearing bright, sparkly jewellery and walked down a dark alley alone at night, seems like prosecuting the victim rather than the perpetrator.
I think the problem was that they hadn't done their due diligence, and they didn't have proper systems in place.
That is it. So that's just why I started off my analogy as Interserve was the muggy, not the mugger.
Yeah.
And then I moved on in my mind and I thought, no, they're not that. The employees are the muggies. The employees of Interserve are the muggies. Interserve is the parent. So if a small child gets, you know, brutally attacked in the dead of night wandering the streets alone,
or comes home with a hand grenade saying, "Look what I found, Mum."
The parents that would be, you know, hauled up before the beak to say, "Why are you letting your toddlers out in the middle of the night to go walking the streets so that they can get horrible things can happen to them?" So Interserve has sort of got an in loco parentis role here. And therefore I decided it perhaps wasn't unfair and unreasonable that they should be they should be fined. And it reminded me that we ran a piece back in February, something on the back of this. GCHQ's National Cybersecurity Centre actually published guidance on cyber threats, specifically for construction companies, specifically on the back of this Interserve attack. It was the Chartered Institute of Building was involved in this as well. And it's particularly aimed at small and medium-sized firms who might not have the massive IT departments that companies like Interserve you had thought would have, but clearly didn't at this stage. So you can find this. It's probably on the CIOB's website. It's if you Google National Cybersecurity Center, Cybersecurity for Construction Businesses, it's called, at ncsc.gov.uk. So that is a very timely reminder that is worth digging out.
I mean, I think sort of cyber crimes of this sort of magnitude are thankfully fairly rare, because I don't know. I was going to say because, but I don't know the reason why they are rare, because it seems to me a story like this suggests that we are all incredibly vulnerable. So, you know, just a moment's lapse of concentration. I mean, I've done it before now. I've opened an attachment to a dodgy email, not realizing that it was dodgy until I opened it. And then, of course, I worried for hours that it had infected my computer and my hard drive and all the rest of it, and had been sent to all my contacts. And luckily it hadn't. But if it had been a really nasty virus or piece of malware, it could have wreaked havoc. And again, you know, it's just simply a lack of, you know, a momentary lack of concentration, and they've got you. So I'm surprised we don't hear more about this, particularly in the construction sector, because, you know, construction projects and contractors and the whole supply chain is very sort of dispersed in the construction industry. And you'd think that it'd be very easy to sort of find a way in for a, for a cyber criminal. So, this was a big problem, and I'm sure that lots of small problems happen all the time, but we don't really hear about them.
Yes, but they find it odd that we've had Tinternet for 20 years now, yeah, and email and everything, and that it's still you'd have thought that we would have solved this problem properly. It wouldn't be possible. There would be absolute guaranteed. And I know things are getting better, and you know, we're getting smarter, but it still seems like, to use an analogy, the drugs cheats in sports. Mm. They always seem to be, the bad guys always seem to be able to, you know, keep one step ahead.
It's an arms race. And the thing is that the 99.9% of users of internet technology don't really know anything about internet technology. I mean, I open my computer and I open a Word document, or I go online, send and receive emails. I don't know what's going on behind my screen. But there are people out there who do and use that to their advantage.
I had occasion to take the back of my computer the other day. I think I needed to hoover up all the dust that was in it. And I was amazed how little is in there. Yeah. There's almost nothing in this box beside my desk.
Well,
actually empty.
I know. Plenty of room for a criminal to sneak in there and hide. You say that it's 20 years. We had the internet for 20 years. I think 1995 was when I first...
30. Yeah,
something like that.
Yeah, sorry.
Even so, I still think that that's... In terms of technology development, that's perhaps still early days. You know, we're still developing the technology. It's developing very, very fast as well, and so I don't know. I suppose that if you're ahead of the curve, then you know you hold all the trump cards. So if there's a criminal out there who is extremely clever at coding or software engineering, then if they're determined to use it for nefarious purposes, then you know the race is on. You've got to find them, but we can't do anything about it except back everything up, don't give out our passwords, don't open dodgy looking emails, and make sure that our virus software is up to date.
Yes, it is in the construction industry, as if not... No, I'm not going to. I would say more than it's as important as PPE.
Yeah,
it is part of your office PPE.
Yeah. Good way of describing it. Yes, indeed. As you say there, but for the grace of God, go I.
that's a segue, Dave. This is a segue.
Oh yeah,
I'm leading on from PPE.
Okay, so well, where are we going?
Well, this is just an item. So I don't think it's particularly significant. We talked enough about Lang O'Rourke last time, so we don't want to become the Lang O'Rourke show. But I was rather taken that Lang O'Rourke have got new corporate PPE, corporate uniforms, that high-vis red polo shirts, red softshell jackets, and charcoal grey cargo trousers that have been specially designed for them to make them look more like the press release we got was saying they now look like Formula One rather than your ordinary scruffy construction workers with their low flying trousers.
Well, yeah, we've got that that cliche of the builder's crack, haven't we? But I think it is quite interesting because a lot of contractors have, I don't know, sort of signature PPE, like, you know, the hard hats will have their logo on it, and you know, maybe they'll have the company name across the back of a high-vis jacket. But this is slightly different because it's more like a uniform. It's a site uniform, and that seems to me to be a sort of a new concept almost in the construction industry. I mean, you don't see Balfour Beatty uniforms or Kier uniforms or, I don't know, costing.
No, you do see a lot of corporate yes, branded stuff, especially when they're public facing. I mean, if they're in the whole facilities management stuff and you know, going to people's homes or offices, they'll be a uniform, but not so much generally on site. I don't
think. No, that's true. I think it's very much up to site workers to wear what they want to wear, and of course, a lot of site workers are agency workers, or they are subcontractors. They're not actually on the staff of the tier one contractor, and so they'll wear their own stuff. So you might find that you could have whole mixture of different uniforms on site, but basically they all wear their own stuff. But they might wear a Lang O'Rourke hard hat when they're on a Lang O'Rourke site. The thing which I found rather amusing, just as an aside, was that the uniform was designed by German Street Design, and I thought that sounds extremely posh, you know, sort of bespoke, made to measure.
But they're based in Hammersmith, not
yeah,
German
yeah,
Street.
Yeah, not German Street. Yeah, so, yes, yes, German Street Hammersmith, not German Street W1 or wherever it is. Yeah, so not what you would normally expect from German Street tailors, but still pretty smart nonetheless. And I think there's, you know, in other industries, people wear uniforms, don't they? Sort of delivery drivers and, well, security people. Why not contractors?
Well, bank clerks.
Yeah, exactly.
Supermarkets.
Yeah,
masses
yeah.
do.
So why
yeah.
not?
But I think what's interesting about this and what is possibly significant is that I think Lang O'Rourke have got a high rate of on-the-books employees who work for them rather than labour-only yeah. subcontractors, as you say. So they are part of a team. And I think a part of the motivation for this is to help, I won't say create, I'm not suggesting that they're not a team already, but help engender and foster the sense of
yes.
team. And that if you're all wearing the same colour, you're yeah. all on the same team. Now, if you're the kind of contractor who you've only got a couple of managers on site and everyone else actually is works for subcontractors, mm-hmm. if they're all in different uniforms, that could almost have the opposite effect. If you've got eight teams yeah. on the pitch at the same time, and it could even prove divisive. But if you've got a whole team of people on site,
yeah.
all in the same, you know, visibly in the same team, I can see that is a positive contribution to workplace productivity, perhaps. Maybe I'm being naive.
Well, no, I don't think you are. I mean, it's the old school uniform debate again, isn't it? I mean, when I was back at school in the 70s now, this was a big thing. There was a trend away from school uniforms, wasn't there? I don't know, at your school, you probably wore a school uniform. But and in fact, I wore a school uniform all the way through my school years, but they fell out of fashion in the 70s and early 80s, I think, because people were individuals and they needed to express themselves and wear their own clothes and all the rest of it. But I am a believer in school uniforms. I think that they do exactly what you've just described, that they do create a sort of...
Why am I not surprised, David?
I think it creates a sort of an esprit de corps. You belong together. You're a group. You're interdependent to some degree. And it doesn't mean that you're not an individual, but it does mean that you belong with your fellow schoolmates and, in the case of Lang O'Rourke, the Lang O'Rourke team on site. And I think that does have a quite significant effect on behaviour and attitude. I think if you feel like you belong, it changes your outlook slightly. You're not just sort of doing your own thing. You're part of a team and you're pulling together. So, I mean, I don't know how much Lang O'Rourke has invested in this, but I think it's probably money well spent. Depends how well the workforce takes to it. If they're happy wearing the PPE, assuming they're not going to have to buy it themselves, but it's issued to them free of charge, it's probably worth a few grand just to make a point, I suppose.
That'd be more than a few grand, I would have thought. I mean, how many employees have Lang O'Rourke got? I don't know.
I don't know.
Google it. Hang on. 12,000. So
12,000.
Nearly 13,000 employees. Now,
right, okay. So that does add up, doesn't it?
Let's assume that a couple of thousand might be in roles where they don't need PPE, probably more than a couple of thousand. But even if half of them, even if 6,000 or only 5,000 are getting this snazzy new gear, yeah, that's, I would say, £100,000?
Probably, yeah.
At least. More.
Not an awful lot, really, is it? I mean, would that be petty cash to Ray O'Rourke? I don't know. But I still think it's probably worth it.
Yes, well, I agree. I think. Well, let's see. What I want to know is, will it start a trend? Will other people
yeah.
start to be doing this? Well, some already do, of course, yeah. but, you know,
yeah.
go wider.
Do you think we should go down this route, Phil, and get a construction index uniform? I wonder what it would look like.
I have nothing to say to that point.
Silence.
Are we done? Are we dusted?
I think we probably are. Talking nonsense now.
Well, from another episode of Reconstruction, thank you everyone for listening, and particularly thank you to our particularly wonderful sponsors this month. David and I will be back again in due course, but for now, goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.